Brought to you by The Register, biting the hand that feeds IT.
Welcome to the InfoSmack Podcast
with your hosts, Greg Nierman and the notorious Mark Farley.
Hey now!
With the diva of disruptive technologies, Christina Wild.
Hear the latest on enterprise tech from the industry pundits and insiders.
Storage.
Yes!
Virtualization.
Yes!
Servers.
Yes!
And networking.
Yes!
Make sure you visit theregister.co.uk for show notes and more. The InfoSmack podcast begins transmission now.
Thank you for joining us for episode 96 of InfoSmack, the show that covers the world of enterprise tech with our favorite industry pundits and insiders, starting with our world-class guests. And as you can tell, I'm not Mark or Greg. They took the week off for the holiday and left me in charge. This week's show was actually recorded a couple of weeks ago at Storage Networking World when Greg and Mark sat down with Dr. D-Dupe Larry Freeman from NetApp, an author of Evolution of the Storage Brain, where he talks about engineering, sales, all the way to product management, which I guess will be my next career path. W. Curtis Preston of BackupCentral.com also sat in for the discussion. If you listen carefully, you can tell Larry's not a big fan of InfoSmack's banter, but he plays along nicely. Curtis, well, he gets in a good heckle with Greg. So without any more banter, enjoy episode 96 of InfoSmack.
Well, welcome to another great InfoSmack episode. This is another live episode from SNW, and this is episode...
Isn't it pronounced SNW?
No, it's SNW.
It's not SNW.
No, SNW. And stepping on my toes already is W. Curtis Preston. And we've also got a distinguished first guest who's never been on the podcast before, Dr. D-Dupe.
Hey,
thank you.
I'm relatively happy to be here.
Doctor.
First-time caller, long-time listener.
So, Larry, you were filling my head up with hot air before about how great you love the podcast.
Yeah, with the exception of the first 20 minutes, I really find them captivating.
So you don't like this kind of banter?
Well, I mean, in the interest of time, I could skip the banter.
Huh.
Wow. Well, how are we on foreplay?
So wait, you're actually implying then that the rest of the show actually is substantive?
In most cases, I think.
Well, yeah. We'll take those. Yeah. Well, that's great. So, Larry, why don't you tell us a little bit? You got a book that's either out or coming out? Or
I do. I have a book out. It's actually been out for about a year. It's called Evolution of the Storage Brain. And it chronicles my 30-year history in the storage industry.
Dude, you're old.
Whoa. Yeah. Well, thanks for pointing that out. I've taken all the mirrors out of my house tonight.
So why don't you give us a quick Cliff Notes version of your 30-year career?
Sure. So my background is engineering. I was a customer engineer, systems engineer, applications engineer, design engineer. And then I got sick of always fixing things. So I moved into sales for about 10 years. And I wouldn't say I was a great salesman, but I was capable because I actually understood technology. And after missing my family growing up, being on the road for 10 years in sales, yeah. I decided to do something where you could make good money without working hard, and I went into product management.
Oh,
hey! I thought you decided to be an author.
No, that was the next evolution.
Yeah,
to work even less and make no money, I decided to be an author.
I think the secret of this business is to just be a celebrity.
Yeah.
And now you're on InfoSmack. You're well on your way.
Well, you were a celebrity before you came on InfoSmack.
True.
Everybody knows Dr. D-Dupe.
In my own mind, right. Absolutely. That's true.
So your full-time gig is at NetApp.
I am. I'm a technologist.
And what did they do?
At NetApp. And that means I talk a lot and hope people listen.
You know, so the other thing, actually, that you do, actually, you've written a book. You write well. You're a good writer.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. From another author, that's really
kind
comment.
This is the author's podcast.
The author's roundtable.
It is the three authors and Greg.
Yeah. He occasionally writes email.
Yeah,
and he writes up these really nice agendas for the show.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
He's really good at that. You read 2 minutes before we actually do a show.
Right. Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah. Yes, it is. So, yeah, Curtis, what's your book?
Well, my three books.
Your three books?
My latest book is Backup and Recovery. Ingeniously titled, by the way.
Yeah, that is creative.
Yeah, it's very.
And Mark, your book is the acclaimed 2001
Building Storage Networks. Yes.
That's great. So
how's the second? I'm sorry.
There was a second edition out. I do get checks. And then I had Storage Networking Fundamentals for Cisco Press. That was 2004.
Right. Yeah. No 2011 edition?
There's the comic book thing I want to do.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah.
Keep that under comics.
We got to keep that under wraps.
Oh, yeah. That's top secret.
Is that the new superhero, H.P. Sisyphus?
H.P. Sisyphus is not writing that book. No, that's a nom de plume.
So you're taking notice of
hey, we're bantering here, by the way. Did you notice
this
that?
Is totally worthless banter. Isn't this fun, Larry?
See,
you know, I'm kind of getting into it now.
Yeah.
Where's the beer?
Do you appreciate it? A little bit?
I think I'm starting to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go back.
Buy that man a drink.
Let's go back to the book. Is that what you were about
to say? Let's go back to the book. Yeah.
So the book is a walk through the storage industry since 1980, and I talk about what succeeded and what failed, and I try to articulate why certain things succeeded, like the Symmetrix, like storage area networks, and why things failed, like AuSpex is one thing, and SSPs was another thing that failed. That was a very notable failure.
They didn't fail, they just got resurrected.
Well, I suppose so, yeah, but nobody dares call himself an SSP
but
anymore.
I think you look at that SSP whole thing, you know, with all the money that was poured into it, you certainly couldn't call it winning.
No. That's true.
Winning.
Now, I use history to help predict the future, and that really was the reason I wrote the book, because I look at what's happened over the last 30 years, and I project out for the next 30 years what I think the significant trends will be in storage.
And so can you throw out one gem for us? A freebie?
Well, you know, there's one thing that I'm really passionate about, and I seem to be the only one that has this view. I think hybrid disk drives are just a no-brainer, that we're going to be using hybrid disk drives within the next 5 years. And the reason for hybrid disk drives, which is a combination of flash with traditional spinning disk, is not for performance reasons, but it's for drive spin down.
Mm-hmm.
If you can have 10% of your data on disk up front in cache, then you can logically now spin down disk drives in a practical manner.
Oh, I like the way you think.
I like the way you comment.
Wow.
This is going to be a love fest.
Are you thinking just from a power cooling perspective?
Spin down that is all about power and cooling.
Yeah.
But people have tried it, notably Copan, and a few other vendors have dabbled in it, but it's just not practical because there's so much background processing that has to go on a disk drive to do consistency checks and things like that. And that still has to be resolved to a certain extent because you don't want to sacrifice reliability to save some kilowatts. But if you use the 80-20 rule, if you can stage at least 10 to 20% of your data on cache up front, and the cache is intelligent on the disk drive, the other 80% is probably not going to be accessed that frequently. So now, again, you can effectively start to think about effective spin down of disk drives.
Be an interesting controller, right? These background processes to flush, if you will, the disk drive cache out to disk.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, I was talking to another vendor about that this week, and he had something I didn't think about. He said you could actually stripe the cache across several drives. If you've got one drive that's really hot and 50% of its data is constantly being accessed, just use the cache on the other drives that aren't being requested and use that to further...
Stop it. You're exciting.
Yeah, I'm
me.
Hurting your head, aren't I?
Yeah. Okay, all you intellectual property people, take that.
His hair is curly as we speak.
So the second part of that prediction is it won't be one of the well-known storage vendors that come up with this idea. It's going to be another data domain. It's going to be a player to be named later that's going to figure this out.
Oh, yeah, I think so, too. There will be some group of engineers that will...
Probably listening to this podcast right now.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
I think the name of the company will be 4PAR.
Well, so if you're making these predictions like this, or you're anticipating future trends based on history, and this is a really interesting one, have you had anybody come up to you and say, hey, we'd like to do that? No, I not... Please don't
other
name
than
names,
you?
But no. Well, I had that happen to me once, actually, but it turned out to be one of the big crash and burns. Mm.
Was that your idea about making storage out of wood?
No, it was when I wrote the first edition of Building Storage Networks. I said all this stuff about fiber channel being a channel and Ethernet not a channel is a hoo-ha. Connecting any of these things across a network is fine. And so I had written how you could put these protocols over Ethernet. And I didn't really quite know what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. The fact is that you could. And then it was the company that came out with storage over IP. Who was that? They took in a lot of money and crashed and burned. Oh, gosh.
You mean sarcastic? Are you,
no, no.
You
very serious company. Yeah. I just can't remember who it was. And I remember getting the phone call that one day from the CEO of the company. It was before he formed the company. He said, you know that thing you wrote in the book? We're going to do it.
Oh.
And I said to him, you know that thing that I wrote in the book? You know, it was me making it up.
you're like the Ray Bradbury of...
Yeah.
No, not Ray Bradbury. Let me say that again. You're the Gene Roddenberry of storage.
Yeah, so that'll probably happen to you at some point, Larry. Somebody will call you up and you should say... find some engineers.
Yeah, I'll take full credit for the idea, and I'll let somebody else actually spend the money on doing it.
Yeah. And time, and the yes. 8 years or whatever.
And sadly make the money, sadly.
Yeah, perhaps, yeah. Perhaps. But I'll still always have the idea as mine.
Welcome to the world as book authors.
So back to the book. Sure. You talk about successes and failures. In your time in this industry, what's been the most monumental failure you've ever seen?
Well, going back to the SSPs, I think it has to be a storage network. Incorporated, ooh. SNI.
Yeah.
Raised $500 million.
Oh!
Crashed.
Ow.
And nobody really paid attention. And the only reason that they were able to do that without the scorn of the investor community was because it happened at the same time all the dot-coms were exploding.
So what do you attribute it? What do you attribute their failure to? What did they miss?
Yeah, it's very easy. They were ahead of their times. They were trying to build a dark fiber infrastructure around the world. And, you think about it now, you think, well, that's crazy. And obviously it was because they didn't survive. Today, you're right, this being resurrected as cloud computing, utility-based storage, it really is the SSP model. The difference is today we have that infrastructure with the internet. You don't have to build a dark fiber network.
Some of the conventional wisdom that I've heard as far as why they failed was, they were, in theory, in practice, what they were bringing to market was ahead of its time, but also foundationally, the technology they were using really wasn't well adapted to what they were trying to achieve, and it didn't have a lot of scalability and performance.
No, it was an incredible investment that they had to make to do these points of presence around the world. And the companies that were buying their services, the few that were the dot-coms that eventually imploded at the same time they did.
Yeah. And the word I had was from somebody who worked on the inside was also that they, even though they had this giant investment, they didn't seem to spend a lot of said investment on things you should invest on.
Mm.
As in, that they seemed to want to hold on to cash. And not invest.
Not invest in the infrastructure.
Yeah, not invest in the infrastructure.
Well, it was a build it and they'll come model. And they built it and a few people came, but not many.
But Greg, to your point, I think the systems back then weren't capable of multi-tenancy support.
Right. That's exactly what I heard.
That was huge. Yeah.
That's interesting. And it's funny, in cloud terms today, a few people mention multi-tenant synonymous with clouds, but I don't hear it all the time. I kind of look at multi-tenancy as a staple of clouds and a distinguishing characteristic of a cloud versus a SAN, for instance, that multi-tenancy features. And none of people are talking about it. I know 3PAR, that was a big deal at 3PAR, I know. But beyond 3PAR, a year ago, was anybody else talking about multi-tenancy? The guys like a compellent razor hand, we're multi-tenant too. I still have my doubts of whether they truly are. Everybody's got their own definition of that.
I'm seeing it used more frequently.
Are you?
Certainly.
Well, NetApp was talking about it. We were fortunate. We already had a device that provided multi-tenancy. We call it vFiler, which is now called multi-store, but it's logical partitioning of a physical
you guys were.
Entity.
Yeah.
We didn't call it multi-tenancy until it became popular, though.
So, let's talk about your work at NetApp. So you look back as far as success and failures and looking out to the future.
Right.
How do you apply that to your work at NetApp?
Well, I apply it by talking with our technical directors, talking with our the people in the CTO office, and trying to, in some small way, influence the decisions they're making on where they're making their investments in the future. And then, don't get me wrong, we've got a lot of smart people at NetApp, and I probably learn more from them than I offer. But it's just a part of a collaboration to make sure that we're on the right track And then more importantly, what I do is, you know, once we decide what engineering direction we're going, and I try to figure out how to communicate it to the industry in a way that everyone understands the value.
How did you come up with the name Dr. D-Dupe?
Dr. D-Dupe was a very casual comment that was thrown my way at a meeting. I was hired at NetApp to help launch our deduplication product. So I decided that I was going to fully immerse myself in this, and since I had an engineering background, I really wanted to understand the architecture so I could explain to people how it worked and why they should use it. And I happened to be in a meeting, one of my managers looked over at me, and it was some dialogue that was going on. He says, "Hey, Dr. Dupe, what do you think about that?" And the room broke up in laughter. And it's just one of those nicknames that that stuck. Like Lefty.
Not Lefty. Chris has got a few nicknames that we can't mention.
Like Sisyphus.
Mr. Backup is one we can. How did you just anoint yourself Mr. Backup?
It was the same kind of thing where, you know, I heard people say it here and there. But, yeah, definitely at some point it was like, okay, it's a cool term. I'm going to brand it and use it wherever I can. And
Yeah.
And run with it. Everybody knows you as Dr. D-Dupe now.
Yeah, well, and the reason they know me is through my blog. So I had already had this internal nickname, Dr. D-Dupe. I was kind of like the Cosmo Kramer of NetApp.
The Cosmo Kramer.
A little eccentric, but if you listen to him, he actually had some sense in what he was saying. So then the opportunity arose. They asked me to start doing a blog, and of course you have to name your blog. And I said, well, let's call it Ask Dr. D-Dupe, which in retrospect was a brilliant decision because I didn't realize it at the time. We have about 40 NetApp bloggers now, and they're listed alphabetically.
Hey!
Oh, nice.
So Ask Dr. D-Dupe was ahead of Dave Hitz's blog.
Oh. Yeah.
So that gave me some early indication on how important the name would be.
Where were you working before NetApp? What were you doing?
Just before NetApp, I worked for a tape library company in Boulder you might have heard of called Spectralogic.
Yeah.
I spent about 8 years there. Started out in sales and moved into product management.
Yeah, Nathan Thompson's company.
Yeah, yes, Nathan, sir. Good guy.
Yep.
Yeah. They've been doing it a long time.
They have.
Well,
they had
their 25th awesome anniversary stuff. While I was there. So
25th anniversary. Yeah. Oh, that's a good long. It's a good long run.
Yeah, they're like the opposite of storage networks. You know, the whole meaning not taking. They took, like, no outside investment.
No, he's totally privately funded, yeah. He started the company when he was still a student at CU.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. So give some examples of some technologies that you've evangelized within NetApp that made it to market.
Well, deduplication, for one. That made it to market. Are you suggesting that there are some technologies that didn't make it to market?
I don't know. I'm not presuming anything.
No, my evolution at NetApp has been first with deduplication, then they asked me to broaden my evangelization to storage efficiency in general. So we put together a group of seven features, and we call that our storage efficiency feature set. And since then, now I'm kind of just evangelizing all new technologies at NetApp. So anything from virtual storage tier to secure multi-tenancy, anything that's interesting these days.
Is there anybody that has the job of following Alex McDonald and cleaning up?
That job has been offered to many people, but surprisingly nobody wanted to do it.
You can't find an intern somewhere? And that might be dangerous too. So, you know, Larry, I kind of play my hand at predicting the future as well, and I got some predictions about NetApp. You want to hear one?
if my response is optional.
You don't have
it's always optional. You can say no comment. I once had a whole show where I said no comment.
Well, that's when during the whole 3PAR acquisition.
That's true.
Mark
yes.
couldn't talk. So,
yes.
So my big prediction for NetApp is I think it could be working for Oracle in a quarter.
I thought it was going to be April 1st.
No.
I think I remember hearing that on a podcast.
Yeah, I do listen to the podcast.
Please.
No, it was not April 1st. It was during the month of April at some point.
Oh, be wrong. That's all I'm saying.
No, you know what I heard? What I heard at lunch today. I probably shouldn't be
fair. Oh, at
but
lunch?
No, what I heard at lunch today, just at lunch today, was Cisco. That's what I heard.
Cisco what?
Buying that app.
Well, now that would totally destroy the EMC relationship. I know, Larry, we won't force you to comment on that, but that would throw the universe out of whack.
It would.
But Oracle makes more sense than I think.
Really?
There's some synergies there. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting though is obviously these large companies, you know, there's the feeling, there's the perception that they need to do something more than what they're doing in the storage space. That's what's interesting. And
Well, speaking of acquisitions, Larry, did you have anything to do with Ingenio or looking into that? Or
oh, yeah, I was completely behind that entire acquisition. and at 2 o'clock on whatever day it was, I found out at the same time everybody else had that this was a pending acquisition.
So any comments or feedback? Can you comment or give us some feedback on that?
I can't comment other than to say that I like change and I find it very interesting, and it provides me a new opportunity to do more evangelizing around a more diverse portfolio. So I personally am excited about it.
Yeah, it looked like a good move to me.
It looked like a great price, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome price.
It looked like the financial markets wanted to punish NetApp for it, but it's like, what do these guys know?
Yeah, sometimes you can't follow what do the financial guys know? Yeah. DuPlessis gave us a good beatdown on not paying too much attention to what the financial analysts say or do.
True. Yes, he did.
Curtis, don't let us interrupt you. We're just recording a podcast.
Curtis is texting.
I was looking
for
something to participate with.
Are you geotagging this podcast right now, Curtis?
Yeah. I mean,
what is going on?
This is like Greek food class. You got
I was running.
Going.
I was running.
Get those chips.
NetApp and Oracle through the Anagram Finder and seeing if I could find anything.
Nothing. No, I'm sorry.
I got
NetApple
Canopy. Canopy Petrol. That's the closest I got. It's nowhere near what happens when you take Sun and Oracle and put them together.
Snorkel?
You get larcenous. I love that.
So, Larry, you've been in the business a long time. You talked about doing it for 30 years. Are there storage companies that you haven't worked for?
Oh, there are a few, yes.
Any that you wish you worked for?
Oh, that's
you know, in the book I talk about Xyotech, and when I saw the first Xyotech Magnitude, in fact, I was at Spectralogic, and they came in to do a demo for us. And I was blown away by the fact that you could actually add a disk drive to a LUN and increase the size of the LUN on the fly. That was unheard of back then. This was around 2000. And it was my first exposure to virtualized storage. And I respect them for that. I commented on them in the book. And that's you know the kind of company that does things that are untraditional are the companies that really interest me.
Who out of the startups that are out there right now pique your curiosity personally?
Well, I think Violin. What they're doing with solid state, I think, is interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, we all know solid state eventually is going to take over the world. It's just a question of when. But
what's unique about Violin that interest?
Just the fact that they're building storage systems around solid state and the way they're doing it and adding intelligence to it. You know, in the company Fusion IO, anybody that's doing something around memory and solid state, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with that and when. You're going to see the crossover point between spinning disk and solid-state disk.
Well, and as you say, the use of hybrid drives.
Hybrid drives, I predict there's going to be a bridge period with hybrid drives, but I could be wrong. And maybe solid-state, the prices will come down, reliability goes up, and it suddenly becomes economical to move to solid-state faster.
What about self-encrypting disk drives? Any thoughts there?
You know, at Spectralogic, we had self-encrypting tape libraries.
Yeah.
You know, for a small segment, it was very interesting. For the rest of the people, who cares? NetApp made a pretty bold move when they bought Decrew several years ago. And again, for a small segment, they needed to have that level of encryption. Most customers, it wasn't important.
I would... Argue is a strong word, but I would, is there a better word than argue?
Suggest?
I don't know. I'll stick with
pontificate.
So when you look at the Decrew acquisition, I would agree that there was a very small percentage of customers that were willing to pay that premium,
mm-hmm.
right? But the whole self-encrypting disk drives idea is that there shouldn't be a premium, that it should just be a chip, and we're done with it.
There is a premium, though, in management and in the time it takes to put in keys, do key management.
And then what the impact on deduplication?
Well, sure.
No,
but
there's none if you do it right, from what I understand.
Let's face it, humans are fundamentally lazy.
Yeah.
And if they don't need to do something, they won't. And you might lose a laptop here and there and lose some sensitive data, but I think by and large, I in my career, I haven't seen a lot of demand for encryption from the average citizen.
So I'm going on record. He's wrong. I'm right.
I don't know. You think people are industrious and want to?
No.
He's right. He's right about. I completely agree about the hybrid drives. I think self-encrypting disk drives are going to take off. That's what
you gotta take off when
we have to solve the management. Right? We have to solve the management issue. You're completely right.
So security is hard, as it should be.
Security is hard.
And in certain cases, you have to go through that pain to be secure.
The problem is key
management is almost impossible.
The problem is the level of tolerance that keeps going down of the level of tolerance that the average user has for the loss of data, right? And it just keeps happening, and just a thought.
That's why it's all going to be in the cloud. We'll just encrypt the cloud.
Yeah.
Hey, so one of the things that we'd like to do with guests is find out what they use for their, personal technology. You are a iPad user?
I am not.
Okay. Laptop?
I do have a laptop.
That's good.
What do you have against the iPad?
It's unencrypted, by the way. I have a BlackBerry. I'm actually an anti-technology person in my personal life. I like to remove as much technology as possible.
Fascinating.
And it's probably because I deal with technology every day. Sometimes you just want to get away from it.
So you read real books?
I do read real books.
Fascinating. Tree killer.
I try not to use my cell phone or my BlackBerry unless it's absolutely necessary. But I enjoy
technology. You don't take a lot of calls on the weekend, then?
I do not. Yeah. I do not.
You're not one of these Apple fanboys. Every guy in the storage industry these days seems to be an Apple fanboy.
I have to say, every time I have a problem with an email attachment, I can't read the Word file. It doesn't open. It says it's not the right format. I don't even have to ask the person who sent it to me. They're using a Mac product, an Apple product.
I like this guy.
You do. I know you would.
One of the things I kind of have got, I don't know if you've listened to the podcast, I'm not a big iPad fan. I think it's a great media consumption tool for those that want to do that. But it's kind of funny how I think people have kind of extended the use of the iPad way beyond.
I really wanted one today.
Well, I may actually get one, but I'll use it to watch movies or something. I'm not going to pretend that I can manage a virtual view environment.
None of that crap, yeah.
And that's so. You and I are probably more alike than.
Oh yeah, we are. But I really wanted one over the last 2 days, and I was really jealous of the people that could just walk around with their iPad, take a few notes, and show some photos, and show some. I got my first presentation today on an iPad. I got a photo. I haven't tweeted it yet, but somebody gave me a presentation on an iPad, and I thought that was really cool that they could just carry around their iPad instead of what I'm doing, which is a giant backpack.
Get a projector and show it to you on a screen so you guys can see it. Jeez, who wants to watch a presentation? First of all, who wants to sit through a PowerPoint presentation in the first place? And then who wants to sit through one that's on a 10-inch screen?
what was really funny was he at one point he rested his hand on the screen and he was making a point, just sort of rested his hand, and he was looking at me, and what he wasn't noticing was the thing underneath was like trying to size it. Jumping up. What do you want? Do you want me bigger, smaller, bigger, smaller, bigger, smaller? That was pretty funny.
Nice.
I want to turn the attention back to Larry's book, if we could. What have you got any criticism from it? What's the, obviously, it's tough. How can anybody criticize your own reflections? But
sure,
have you been challenged on anything in it?
I really haven't. All the feedback I've gotten has been positive, at least, and all the feedback I know of is people have said it's easy to read. It does a good job in explaining kind of complex intricacies of storage in a way that people can understand. And at NetApp, we actually use it for new hires to say, if you haven't been in the storage industry or if you haven't been in lately, here's a good way to bring yourself up to speed.
Wow.
Who's your publisher?
My publisher is self-published, and it was through CreateSpace. And an interesting story there, CreateSpace is owned by Amazon. And I knew I was going to self-publish, but I wasn't sure who I was going to go through. And I just happened to see a website for CreateSpace. I submitted the PDF file, and the next day FedEx delivered a printed copy of the book.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
And I was blown away by it.
Wow.
Is there an electronic version of it available?
There is. There's an e-book available for the Kindle, and also it's an iBook on Apple's.
You can read that on the iPad you could buy.
I could.
I should download it to my
your iPhone?
Android right now.
Yeah, oh, my God. Go. Who wants to read a book on a side?
No.
I just want to do this while we're recording the podcast. This is a stunt, Greg.
Okay,
come on.
Look.
It's a stunt.
I'm an
it's
Android.
A bit.
It's stupid. I'm an Android fanboy. I love it. But, what's a 5-inch screen is not designed to read a book.
I've got 5 other books on here I haven't read yet.
Oh. You know what they call that? They call that an audio book. You should get audio. Oh, that's a good question. Do you have an audiobook version?
Well, you need to read your book.
So in one sense, if you use the Kindle, it becomes an audiobook.
Oh, we want to talk to your voice.
You should let Mark and I read your book.
Oh, yeah.
And instead of a podcast,
we'll just read the page.
Yeah. And we'll ad-lib throughout the whole thing liberally.
Yeah. Banter for you.
There you go. There you go.
Insert our own forward.
Insert your own forward. This book brought to you by InfoSmack, available on theregister.co.uk.
Yes.
We'd really like to thank Larry for letting us do this without telling him.
We don't realize there's a copyright violation in reading somebody's book, but we'll find out.
We'll work on it.
So you self-published this. That's kind of interesting. What were some of the challenges? Obviously, you don't have somebody marketing it for you, or do you?
Sure.
Or how do you bring something like a self-published book to market?
Well, I didn't write the book for the purpose of getting exposure.
Please don't tell me you wrote it for money.
I didn't write the book for money.
Oh,
really,
good.
Really, as I wrote it as a way to kind of be a primer for people at NetApp and our NetApp customers and so forth, and people that I interacted with, in order to give them something that would help educate them on the history of storage.
Is there a website that companion to the book?
Actually, there is. After I wrote the book, I decided I wanted to try to continue the discussion where the book left off, and I put up a website called storage-brain.com. So we've had some fun with that website. I do a storage brain teaser roughly every week. I ask questions from storage history, and people can participate and win valuable prizes.
Oh, you need to have Chris Evans. You need to have Chris Evans do that. He does trivia.
Does he really?
Trivia yeah. shows.
Do you promote that on Twitter?
Sorry?
Do you promote that on Twitter?
I do promote it on Twitter, yes.
I'm not
yes.
seeing that. We got to circulate yeah. that a little bit. That's That could
yeah.
be fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a.
Well, you can see all the old ones on the Storage Brain website. And we also do Friday Fun Facts, where we try to keep it lively and just come up with some interesting facts around storage technologies.
So I'm just going to say this. Chris Evans, if you listen to this podcast, okay, here you go.
That's well,
trivia stuff. Chris goes to his local pub locally or something. He does trivia contests yeah. and that kind of thing. I guess nice. He's quite good.
You know what we should do is have like a storage trivia smackdown on Larry's site. And
yeah.
you know, it could be like there could only be one. And
yeah.
20 go in, one comes out.
A tournament. Storage trivia.
Yeah, storage trivia smackdown. I like
storage
that.
Dome.
Hey, here it is. Evolution of the Storage Brain Kindle Edition. All right.
You're seriously going to read that?
I'm going to do it.
How much is it?
$9.95.
Nice. It's very affordable.
Very affordable. I can't believe you're going to try to read that on a phone, Mark.
I might not read it. This might just be a donation to your retirement fund.
Dude, can you make a PDF and put that on BitTorrent so I can get it?
yeah, you and everyone in China.
If they can only read English.
Pretty well. Yeah, hey, and you know what? It gets 4.5 stars here, which is pretty good.
Nice. That was my vote. No, but seriously, the reason I wrote the book was to help people that I was in contact with at NetApp, our customers and so forth, just to help them have a little leave behind when we brief them and so forth. Not to try to go through a publisher and do a lot of media promotion around it.
Well, Curtis and I both have had the wonderful experience of working with publishers, and I think Curtis's publisher has been a lot better to him than mine. I think the experience of working with a publisher was awful.
Hmm.
Yeah, but Curtis had a little
different deal. Yeah, O'Reilly's been great, and they're really good at has been the promotion part, right? But one really sad fact, and it's one of the reasons why I made the joke about piracy, but I'm actually really like an anti-piracy person. I had a downloaded BitTorrent copy of my book in my hands weeks before I had a physical copy of my
and
book.
And you probably got a cease and desist order from your cable company. for your own material. Wouldn't
yeah,
that be funny?
Yeah.
You've had a couple of people working with this that I like, Michelle Hope and Dave Simpson.
Michelle Hope was my co-writer / research.
Oh, she's
assistant.
Terrific.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, she helped a lot with the formatting and the flow of the book.
Yeah.
And then I asked Dave Simpson to write a foreword, and he graciously accommodated that request.
Yeah. So, Moore Banner, have you kept up with Michelle? What's she doing these days?
She's dealing with some health issues in her family, mm-hmm. so she hasn't been as active as she was, but I really like working with her, and She was a really, we wrote the book in 4 months. I didn't mention that.
Amazing.
Yeah, and, yeah. And at the height, we were writing a chapter a week, and we had several chapters in various stages of completion. And she was extremely valuable in
She's an excellent editor and an excellent writer.
Was it like pen and paper?
Well, the process was I would have a call with her to discuss the outline for each chapter, and I would go through my recollection and say, you know, this is when SCSI was developed, and these are some of the challenges that we had early on with SCSI. And she'd take notes and do a first draft, and at the same time, she'd research to make sure that my recollection was correct. Because, you know, when you get to be my age, it's kind of...
Yeah, things fall through the cracks.
Exactly.
I'll have to remember that when I work on my autobiography. That's good. That's good.
Yeah. Call Michelle.
So she sent me back a first draft. I'd make some edits, send it back to her, and she would do the final final editing.
And so, what was the process like from beginning to end of writing it to when you actually you said you sent the PDF in, and the next day you had the book in the mail?
The process was we started writing it in December. My goal was to publish it on April 1st, April Fool's Day. We, you know, literally at midnight. March 30th, we both agreed that the book was complete. We both were happy with it. I had, about a week before, I decided that I was going to publish it through CreateSpace. So I went on their website, followed the directions, very clear, very easy to understand, submitted the PDF, and then I got an email saying, your book is in print right now, and they gave me the tracking number from FedEx, and it was delivered the next day.
That's pretty awesome. Much exactly the same as your and mine.
Oh, yeah, my experience is just like
that. Yeah.
So do you plan a second edition at some point? Post-retirement edition? Or
I'm toying with a couple of ideas now. So when I wrote the book, my intent was always to go back and update it every 5 years or so and, you know, see what would... have some fun and see what I was right about, what I missed, and so forth. I may actually have to accelerate that schedule because it's like dog years in storage. You know, five years is a long time. Yeah. So I may have to update it every couple years. But I'm also toying with another book now because what really struck me when I was writing the book was how much technology really came from the mainframe. And things that we do today were almost all the ideas today around open storage computing and shared resources and so forth was already done on the mainframe in the 60s and 70s. And we kind of got away from that when Sun came along and came out with distributed computing and silos of storage. We lost the ability to have this big guardian over storage that could manage it in a very efficient way. But with cloud storage, believe it or not, we're coming back to the mainframe environment. So the tentative title of my next book is Building the Virtual Mainframe, because to me, that's really what cloud computing and cloud-enabled storage is.
Sure. Twigo would be happy to do a forward for that one.
Mr. Mainframe?
Yeah.
So that's an interesting question. What do you think of, I'm not talking specifically about NetApp here, I'm talking about industry-wide, what do you think about this push toward convergence, towards this stack of the future? Is it misguided? Are we going back to the mainframe? Is it one of those things where we spent so many years now creating this kind of assembly line infrastructure for IT, now we're going back to what looks like a mainframe?
Well, the beauty of the mainframe was it had control over every peripheral device that it was responsible for managing. So, you know, you had big bus and tag cables that were connected to your storage arrays, your printers, your tape drives. So the management of that was very tight. So to do things like virtualization and to do really efficient utilization of that storage was pretty easy for the mainframe to do because it knew about every byte in the infrastructure. Now, with the economic climate that we're in and the desire to maximize every resource that you have in the IT stack, we're just rebuilding the mainframe now, but we're doing it virtually. So you need to have this overarching authority that has control over your compute resources, your network resources, and your storage resources. That's what a mainframe is.
Do you like that, though? I mean, what's your reflection on it? I mean, do you think this is a positive development, or do you think we're taking a step backwards?
Oh, I think it's definitely a positive development. I mean, again, human nature is humans are lazy, and we really got away from efficient use of our resources through the convenience of client-server computing. And, you know, it worked for a while, but now with the scale that we're looking at of data growth over the next couple of decades, you're just not going to be able to operate in that environment. You're going to hit the wall. You're going to get to a point where you simply can't manage that amount of storage. So you have to go back to a kind of a mainframe mentality and have this overseer of all the resources in your stack.
You know, do you and Dave Hitz sit around and compare who's selling more books?
Yeah, I wish. There's no comparison there.
No.
Yeah.
I always thought if I worked
that would
for
be like me and Steve Wozniak comparing, you know, who's more important in Silicon Valley.
I always thought if I worked for NetApp, I'd write a book called How to Castrate a Kitten. But after this podcast, I'm pretty certain I'll never work for NetApp, so I won't have to worry about that challenge. Larry, thank you very, very much for joining us this week. This has been a real pleasure. I've been a fan of your website, that everybody, your blog, where they can keep up to date with you on Dr. D-Dube. You've got StorageBrain, storage-brain.com.
Yes.
And the name of the book again is?
Evolution of the Storage Brain.
Evolution of the Storage Brain. Also, Curtis, I love seeing you, Curtis.
I love you too.
Mark, isn't it great seeing Curtis at these events?
It is.
Finally, I get to go again.
Yes.
I'm not being scheduled by a large entity that doesn't seem to know when.
It's worse. Now he's got somebody that's scheduling for him, which is driving me nuts. Even getting him hit in here today. Let me check with my people. Are you freaking kidding me? Since when do you have people keeping a schedule? You've got a phone in front of you. Just put it in your calendar.
He might have been pulling your chain.
No, he wasn't.
It might have been
he was not
chain.
Pulling my chain.
If he schedules it, he doesn't show up.
There's a secret guest on the show.
She's a giant whip.
She's a walking alarm clock. Is that it?
Yes. I have no brain. It's like, you know.
Oh, yes, you do. Anyway, Curtis, your website is backupcentral.com. Give us an update of your roadshow for Backup.
Yeah, so Backup Central Live, we did 5 cities earlier this year. Went well. We're doing 5. We've scheduled 15 more for this for the rest of the year.
15?
15 more, yeah, for the rest of the year. And we've sold out. We sold out the first 5 with the sponsorships, and we're just shy of selling out the sponsorships for the next 5. And then it's 5 per quarter.
Are you coming up to the Bay Area?
We already did come to the Bay Area, but we are coming back, San Francisco.
Hey now!
And this quarter, it's Raleigh, Boston, Dallas.
See, this is why I have people.
All right, Curtis, what's the website they should go to?
BackupCentralLive.com.
BackupCentralLive.com.
No dashes.
No dashes.
You know, you guys should do kind of a road show together, you know. Select City's kind of like Charlie Sheen.
Book signing tour.
Winning.
Well, this is great. Again, this is by the time you'll hear this, it'll be about 2 weeks out from S&W, but this has been a great S&W. Larry, you've been to S&Ws before.
I've been to many of them. It's a great show. It's good to connect with people such as yourself and just re-engage with the other vendors and users.
Curtis, reflections on this S&W?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, same. That's what it's about. It's about, you know, connecting with all the different people.
That's great. Now, after doing this, Larry, we were gentle on you. Are you still a fan of the podcast?
Well, I'll have to wait and listen to how much banter we have as opposed to technical content.
That's great.
In fact, we should start measuring the banter ratio on the podcast. Kind of like the D-dupe ratio. It could be the banter ratio.
Oh, you really don't like mindless discussion.
He wants to de-dupe the banter.
Yeah, he de-dupe the podcast.
Yeah, he wants a little chapter marker that he can skip past.
Yeah,
the banter.
I think the register has that technology.
You know, so when we clap, instead of having a lot of clapping, it would just sound like this.
Or you can just listen to it at 2x speed.
Yeah, and it's just, hey.
Now that 10-minute banter is just, you know, 5 minutes of banter.
Yeah.
So.
This is the part where Larry normally just says, okay, they're obviously
show's
done.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll see you next week. Thanks.
You've been listening to the InfoSmack podcast.
Join us for a new episode every Tuesday at theregister.co.uk, where you can also leave comments for the show.